I think our internet people have now joined us, so we'll be underway. Just need one more button to press. Oh, no, we're going apparently. Right, our Bible study on the book of Daniel continues. Last week we did chapters 1, 2 and 3. Chapter 1 introduces us to Daniel, who is taken as a young slave to the land of Babylon from his hometown of Jerusalem. Daniel is a young man, perhaps, we think, in his teen years, but demonstrates early on great wisdom and great courage. In Daniel chapter 2, we come to the strange, amazing dream of King Nebuchadnezzar, who sees this great statue of a man in his dream. The man has a head of gold, chest of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, two iron legs which peter out, so to speak, in 10 toes of crumbly, miry clay and iron. And a great stone appears and smashes the statue in his feet. It breaks up and is blown away. And Nebuchadnezzar has no idea what he's dreamt or what it meant. Daniel gets the answer from God and explains, well, O king, there will be a total of really four great world ruling empires. You are the head of gold, then an inferior empire of silver, then one of bronze, then one of iron, and at the end of the empire of iron, its 10 toes representing 10 kings will be smashed by the Lord of Heaven, who will set up a kingdom of God in those days. And that was an amazing prophecy. Daniel was promoted to being virtually the head man under Nebuchadnezzar. And then, of course, we came to chapter 3, which was some years later. Nebuchadnezzar, perhaps, had just slightly forgotten about the true God of heaven and wanted people to worship the image which he set up. And that got Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into some trouble. They were tossed into a burning fiery furnace, but amazingly survived. And that again surprised, amazed Nebuchadnezzar, and he promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, made them right to the very top of the totem pole. And that's where we ended, I think, last week. So let's pick up the story now in Daniel chapter 4. And this is probably some 30 years or so after Daniel was appointed as the chief or most senior of Nebuchadnezzar's counselor. So some time has passed since we began the story. And chapter 4 is sort of interesting in a sense. It's a whole chapter in the Bible, not written by a man of God, because chapter 4 of Daniel is written by a Gentile king, Nebuchadnezzar himself. The whole chapter, I think, yeah, right to the final verse, it's all written by a Gentile king. So it's quite curious in some ways. And we'll start with verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. So just like in the New Testament, we, you know, Paul, unto the brethren in Rome, grace and peace unto you. So Nebuchadnezzar is writing here a proclamation, or a letter to everybody in his empire. And yet here it is in Scripture. Amazing. Verse 2. I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. You know, in many ways, Nebuchadnezzar must have been a very, very special person. He was certainly, you know, ruthless. We've seen evidence of that. I think a bit of a short temper. We've seen evidence of that, but you know, God did describe him as the head of gold on the statue, the most valuable. And, you know, God seems to have worked rather closely with Nebuchadnezzar. So clearly the man was quite exceptional in his day. Carrying on, verse 3, Nebuchadnezzar writes, how great are his signs and how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. Almost sounds like King David. The language here is Nebuchadnezzar praising the God of heaven and telling all peoples what a great and mighty God this is, just like some of the Psalms you would read. But of course, Nebuchadnezzar is doing this after yet another experience in his life where he got something slightly wrong and it got right eventually, and he's now looking back and recognizing some truths. Verse 4, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in my house. He's giving a story now of the last few years, and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts on my head and the visions of my head troubled me. Remember way back in Daniel 2, there was this other dream which he had of this great statue. Here, some years later, about 30 or so years later, is another troublesome dream which is going to puzzle Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 6, therefore, I issued a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Sounds very familiar. Then the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers came in, and I told them the dream. But they did not make known to me its interpretation. You might have thought they'd have made up a story of some sort to get the king off their back in case he once again talked about slaying them all, but perhaps they thought twice about that. So they just said, sorry, O king, you've told us what you've dreamed, but quite honestly, O king, we haven't got a clue. Verse 8, but at last Daniel came before me. This is, of course, Nebuchadnezzar writing one of the chapters in the Bible. His name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. In him is the spirit of the holy God. And I told the dream before him, saying, Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy God is in you, and no secret troubles you, explain to me the visions of my dream that I've seen and its interpretation. Obviously, Nebuchadnezzar remembered that Daniel was outstanding. He was the wisest man in all the land. You'll recollect last week we saw in the book of Ezekiel that Ezekiel, who was a contemporary of Daniel, as indeed was Jeremiah, Ezekiel says that though the three wisest men, Noah and Job and Daniel, were in a land that could only really deliver themselves. So even in his own lifetime, Daniel was well known for being super righteous in the best sense and amazingly wise. And Nebuchadnezzar obviously is aware of that. He says, verse 10, these were the visions of my head while on my bed. I was looking, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong. Its height reached to the heavens, and it could be seen to the ends of all the earth. So here's a huge tree that he's watching, and it grows up and up, and the branches go out, and eventually it's such a huge tree you can see it from way across the far horizon. Verse 12, its leaves were lovely, its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, the birds of the heavens dwelt in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. So here's an amazing tree, and it provides comfort and security and food and nourishment. It's an amazing tree. And of course we know that Nebuchadnezzar is going to say eventually, well, what's the tree signify, O Daniel? But before we get further, we can just have a sneaky preview in Ezekiel chapter 31. Remember, Ezekiel was writing about the same time as Daniel. They were contemporaries. Ezekiel 31. We can start in verse 3. Indeed, Assyria, talking of a great nation, was a cedar in Lebanon, with fine branches that shaded the forest, and of high stature, and its top was among the thick boughs. So Assyria, the nation, is likened here to a great tree, a cedar of Lebanon. Verse 4, the waters made it grow, underground waters gave it height, with their rivers running around the place where it was planted, and sent out rivulets to all the trees of the field. So we can almost picture here Assyria, the great tree, and other countries nearby, small trees. Verse 5, therefore its height was exalted above all the trees of the field, its boughs were multiplied, and its branches became long because of the abundance of water as it sent them out. All the birds of the heavens made their nests in his boughs, under his branches. All the beasts of the field brought forth their young, and in his shadow all great nations made their home. So Ezekiel is using here, under inspiration, this is the word of the Lord. This is talking of Assyria, a great mighty nation in his day, being likened to a tree, a great tree, and the other nations obtained some security and protection under it. Looking at verse 12, and aliens, because Assyria was to, you know, eventually end, aliens, the most terrible of the nations, have cut it down and left it. Its branches have fallen on the mountains, and in all the valleys its boughs lie broken by all the rivers of the land, and all the peoples of the earth have gone from under its shadow and left it. So a great tree, but a great tree can be cut down, its branches chopped off, and that's what happened to the nation of Assyria. Let's go back to Daniel. So Nebuchadnezzar has seen this great tree, and seen all the birds and all flesh being fed from it, abundant fruit, lovely tree, and visible from all around the world in his dream. Verse 13. He's continuing his vision. He says, I saw the visions of my head while on my bed, and there was a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven. So a watcher, some sort of a spirit being, comes down out of the heavens and cried aloud and said thus, chop down the tree, cut off his branches, strip off his leaves and scatter his fruit. Let the beasts get out from under it, and the birds from his branches. So a bit like we just read of Assyria. Looks like the end of this tree. Nevertheless, verse 15, leave the stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field. Let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts on the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from that of a man, and let him, this tree who it represents, be given the heart of an animal, and let seven times pass over him. And we can probably at this moment just think that, well, okay, seven times is probably 7 years, a time being most of the time, so to speak, a year. So let 7 years pass over him. So this is obviously a bit puzzling to King Nebuchadnezzar. This tree is going to be chopped down, apparently, and something about a man's heart being replaced by an animal, a beast-type mind, and 7 years are going to elapse. What is this all about? Verse 17, this decision is by the decree of the watchers, and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. And that's the dream. So a watcher, whatever one of those might be, comes down from heaven and says that the watchers, plural, have made a decree, and this is the sentence, so that the living might know that the Most High God is the great ruler of all, which of course is something that, among others, King Nebuchadnezzar didn't seem to remember very long. Verse 18, this dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar, declare its interpretation, since all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for the Spirit of the Holy God is in you. So he had great confidence, very sensibly, in Daniel. Daniel, a very righteous man, close to God, and known to be able to interpret amazing dreams. Verse 19. But of course Daniel is stunned when he hears the dream, because God's given him such a tremendous wisdom that he spots straight away what this means, and he's not very happy. Nebuchadnezzar was, as we say, a ruthless man, but must have had some other exceptional qualities. And Daniel, who's been serving him for something like maybe 30 years or so by now, and probably knows his strengths and weaknesses, is like, this is a tricky one. Verse 19. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for a time, and his thoughts troubled him, And so obviously he was just frowning and looking rather awkward, and Nebuchadnezzar could probably spot there's something amiss here. So the king spoke and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, may the dream concern those who hate you, and its interpretation concern your enemies. I'd rather it was somebody else that this dream related to. Verse 20, the tree that you saw, which grew and became strong, whose height reached to the heavens, and which could be seen by all the earth, whose leaves were lovely and its fruit abundant, in which was food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and on whose branches the birds of the heaven had their habitation, it is you, O king. So that's who the tree is. It's a great nation like Assyria, or in this case, the tree represents a great man, a great king. And Daniel says, the tree is you, O king, who have grown and become strong, for your greatness has grown and reaches to the heavens, and your dominion to the end of the earth. Now, obviously, Nebuchadnezzar was a very special man. And inasmuch as the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave its stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts of the field till seven times pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king. So he's about to explain to Nebuchadnezzar exactly, specifically, what this means. And, you know, the watcher is clearly some type of spirit being, an angel perhaps. We don't know a great deal about how God governs, you know, from heaven, but there are some indications here and there that, you know, God has perhaps a sort of council of senior spirit beings with whom he discusses certain things. And it looks like the watchers are perhaps a particular group of angelic beings or whatever, and one of them is sent down in the dream with this message. And so Daniel has now got to tell the king what it meant. Verse 24, this is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king. They shall drive you from men. Your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and 7 times, or 7 years, shall pass over you, King Nebuchadnezzar, until you know, or fully understand, that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, and gives it to whomever he chooses. Something that Nebuchadnezzar probably ought to have sort of cottoned onto by now, but the man was a king, an emperor, no doubt surrounded by sycophants, and was a man of some vanity, and he just felt that really, you know, it was he himself, by his special power, his intellect, his force and vitality, his vigor, who had made him what he was. And he didn't realize, well, actually, you know, I've got some special qualities, but actually, I've become so strong because the Most High God of Heaven has, for his own reasons, been helping me along. And Nebuchadnezzar did not recognize that, and he was totally vain, and God's about to reveal to him a major lesson, which is that you're going to be driven out of your palace, O king. You're going to be driven away from mankind for 7 years. Verse 26, inasmuch as they gave the command to leave the stump and roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be assured to you after you come to know that heaven rules, or that the God of heaven rules. And that's it. That's it, king. You're going to be, you know, sent out of your kingdom. You're going to dwell among the animals for 7 years. And so now that's the, if you like, the interpretation. But now Daniel interjects really his own urgent advice, verse 27, therefore, O king, let my counsel, this is not the dream now, this is just Daniel, let my counsel, my advice, be acceptable to you. Break off your sins. You know, stop sinning. Stop it. be righteous. Stop your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps, if you do that, there may be a lengthening of your prosperity. But, of course, we know from the next few verses that Nebuchadnezzar did not heed that advice, not quite sure what he thought. Perhaps he just thought, maybe, maybe not. Maybe he's got this one wrong, Daniel. Can't be perfect all the time with your interpretations. And a bit unlikely. I mean, hang on. I'm king. I've got soldiers all around me. I'm strong. I don't know what he thought. But anyway, he clearly did nothing about it. And so we get to verse 28. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. Because don't forget, this is Nebu himself writing this chapter. This is not written by Daniel. This is Nebuchadnezzar writing his own chapter of the Bible. So that again tells you something about Nebuchadnezzar, how many men has God allowed to put, you know, a portion of their writings into the scriptures. But here's one of them. At the end of the 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon, which apparently was a spectacular palace. The king spoke, saying, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty?" What a place, what a palace, what a man, what an emperor, you know, what a life. And he looks around, and by all accounts, you know, Babylon would make your eyes pop in terms of just, you know, the sort of spectacular beauty, the hanging gardens of Babylon, you name it, it was there. But of course, it actually wasn't Nebu who had done all this himself. If you turn to Jeremiah 27, and again remember Jeremiah was a contemporary of Daniel and Ezekiel, so he was living at roughly the same time. Jeremiah 27, and picking up in verse 4. Jeremiah 27, verse 4. "And command them to say to their masters, thus says the Eternal of hosts, the God of Israel, thus you shall say to your masters." So this is the word of God. This is God's direct statement. This is what you must say. This is the thus says the Lord. Verse 5. "I have made the earth, the man and the beast that are on the ground by my great power and by my outstretched arm, and have given it to whom it seemed proper to me." And of course, God knows an awful lot more than you and I do. He knows whom to raise up and whom occasionally to step in and bring down. And verse 6. "And now I, the Lord of hosts, have given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant." So how did Nebu get them? By his own great power and might? Well, I guess he did his bit. To be fair, he wasn't, I'm sure, an idler, in a sense of being idle. He certainly had plenty of idols. But he was probably a fairly industrious and a busy and forceful character. But that's not how he got to rule the world. It says here, "Now I," verse 6, "have given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant. And the beasts of the field I have also given him to serve him." Verse 7, "So all nations shall serve him and his son and his son's son until the time of his land comes. And then many nations and great kings shall make him serve them. And it shall be," verse 8, "that the nation and kingdom which will not serve Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and which will not put his neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon, that nation I will punish, says the Lord, with the sword, the famine, and the pestilence, until I have consumed them by his hand." So, you know, God was intervening here and giving Nebuchadnezzar all this rule, giving the nations, the animals, the herds, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. But Nebu didn't sort of really take heed of that, wasn't grateful, and looked in the mirror and thought, "Oh, what an emperor, what a man, what a celebrity I am." So anyway, back to Daniel chapter 4 and verse 30. So he's walking about, admiring himself one day in his palace, and talking about how great he was. In verse 31, "While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven, 'King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, The kingdom has departed from you, and they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and 7 times or 7 years shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, and gives it to whomever he chooses. That very hour the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like the oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair had grown like eagle's feathers, I guess all sort of stiff and so on, and his nails like bird's claws. A wild man. So it seems that, you know, the spirit of man of some sort was taken from Nebuchadnezzar, and he became very much like a beast, dramatically, because it says that very hour. So, you know, 1 hour he's perhaps a good-looking, strong, vigorous, relatively wise man in the prime of his condition, and within 1 hour he's acting like a beast and is driven out from among his people and stays over there scrambling around in the woods and eating who knows what not, until his hair grows long and stiff and unwashed and unkempt, like wings of a bird, like feathers, I should say, and his nails grow long and dirty, like claws of a perhaps an eagle or something, and he's out there being soaked by the rain and the dew. And this is the great, you know, the head of gold. This is the great Nebuchadnezzar, and he's out there like an animal, you know, dramatic, very very quick. And it just shows you how quick things can change, of course. And at the end of this age, we know there's going to be some very beast-like minds around. There are going to be men who perhaps today are in the 30s or 40s or 50s or 60s who are perhaps major politicians or businessmen or leaders in this world, perhaps in Germany, perhaps in other countries, and they're going to change very dramatically. And it can happen. It can happen. Nebuchadnezzar changed in an hour into a beast-like creature. And of course, in his particular circumstances, it lasted for 7 years. And verse 34, and of course, this is still Nebuchadnezzar writing. This is a letter that, or a proclamation that he wrote to all the citizens of the entire empire. So, I mean, everybody knew about it. Probably everybody knew that the man was out in the fields acting like a wild beast. Must have been really a lot of, you know, stories going around, and people in their pubs and clubs talking about, you know, if you heard the latest about Nebuchadnezzar. Now what's happened? He's lost. He's gone insane. He's out in the fields. He's living rough. He's eating grass and who knows what not out there. And the guy is wild. Oh, well, what's going to be done? I don't know. And of course, normally you'd expect if a king lost his marbles, like this one had done, there'd probably be plenty of people rushing in to take over. Because after all, the guy can rule the kingdom, and it's a big kingdom, and there's other empires and nations round about, always people willing to, you know, raise an army and march, and always plenty of pretenders waiting there to try and get their chance to become king. And here you are, driven away for 7 years. Surely, in all that time, all the guys that hoped to be the new king would have rushed in. You know, perhaps said, well, you need somebody to run the kingdom, it must be me now, and so on. But of course God was involved here, and remember the stump and the roots were allowed to stay there, because after 7 years the kingdom is going to be restored. God is not going to let anybody else step in, take over the kingdom and keep Nebuchadnezzar out permanently. This is God's purpose and plan being worked out. Verse 34, at the end of the time, the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me. So he sort of steps up, and suddenly, I guess it's the spirit man is perhaps put back into him, whatever God did there. And suddenly Nebuchadnezzar looks around and thinks, oh, I remember. I remember who I am. I remember what's going to happen. And he looks down and he's all filthy and covered in mud and long dirty nails and probably a beard that's reaching down to his knees and so on. And he, yes. And he says, I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. for his dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom, excuse me, is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? So, you know, Nebuchadnezzar comes to his senses, a much more humble and a much wiser man. At the same time, verse 36, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice. And those who walk in pride, such as me, he is able to abase. Amen, brother, that's for sure. And the best dates on this are somewhere around about the 7 years from sort of 569 BC to 562 BC. And then apparently Nebuchadnezzar died very shortly afterwards. So he ruled a long time, good 40 years or so. He had made amazing strides in terms of becoming a famous king and emperor. He had learned a marvelous lesson here about the great God of heaven and earth. And then shortly after that, maybe a year or two or three or four, something like that, he died. And they were quite amazing. Now, one of the asides to chapter 4 is that the seven times which are mentioned there are in the straightforward application 7 years, and it does seem that Nebuchadnezzar had 7 years running about, like a wolf or something. Some people reckon that the legend of werewolves has its origins in the example of Nebuchadnezzar, who may have looked a bit like a wolf out there with his long shaggy hair and his nails running around like a half man, half beast. But the 7 years or seven times can have another application, which is that 1 year in prophecy, and I'm not going into the detail, others have done that before me, 1 year in prophecy is 360 days. And so seven times would be, if you use this application, 2,520 years. And the supposition is that, okay, there's a duality here. Just as the king of Babylon was sent into obscurity, lost his power and his government and his kingdom for 7 years, so Babylon, the empire of Babylon, will lose its power, might, authority for 2,520 years, which is seven times, each time being 360. In which case, since we know that Babylon fell about 539 BC, if you add on your 2,520 years, you come to something like about 1982-ish, 1981, 1982, after which the strength and power of Babylon could well return, or have started to return. And we'll cover that again a bit later, but mention it there once, because the same period crops up shortly. Okay, that's Daniel chapter 4, so off now to Daniel chapter 5. We've got a new king now, King Belshazzar. This is the end of his rule, so we miss out some of his earlier escapades. But Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of the 1,000. So this is quite a party. You got 1,000 people all knocking back bottles of wine and so on. It's going to be quite something. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father, or his might be his grandfather, I think, probably, Nebuchadnezzar, had taken from the temple which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, plural, and his concubines might drink from them. So, not a good idea, Belshazzar, but here he is. He's had a few bottles already of super plonk, and he's probably starting to lose the plot slightly. And he says, in a slurred voice, no doubt, go and get those gold vessels and things from that temple in Jerusalem. you know, that temple that was allegedly the temple of the great Jehovah God, whatever his name was, go get those cups and plates and let's bring them here and drink from them. Ha ha, and everybody sort of, go on Belshazzar, let's do that. And of course God's watching from heaven and seeing all these vessels that were used previously in the worship of the great God suddenly being brought into a drunken orgy. Verse 3, then they brought their gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. So a merry party. And here you are with vessels that were designed to honor the great God, and they're pouring wine in and sloshing about and lifting up and, okay, now let's have a toast to the God of this, let's have a toast to the God of that. And God's watching, and it's a good time to teach a lesson or two. In the same hour, verse 5, the fingers of a man's hand appeared. Ooh, spooky. And wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. So, you know, you're just watching, and perhaps you're not seeing too clearly with all this wine that's been pouring down your throat for the last couple of 3 hours. But a hand appears. And just to make sure you see it, the hand appears close to the lampstand. You've got a big room, there could be plenty of shadows and dark, but you know, God's making sure things are being done properly. So right opposite where the king's sitting, where the nice lamp with nice bright light radiating, a hand appears and starts writing on the wall. Then, verse 6, the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened, and his knees knocked against each other. I think he had a touch of the old Delhi Belly, or Pharaoh's Revenge, or whatever you want to call it, and he didn't feel too good. Suddenly all that turkey and beef and wine is starting to, I don't feel too good. And the king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, the soothsayers. And the king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and of a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Because, you know, this hand has come and written something on the wall. How can a hand just appear? And what does it mean? What's the writing mean? What is the writing on the wall? And he's frightened, because he'll know it's not good news, I suspect. whoever can interpret that lot, he'll be the third ruler. And because Belshazzar was the second, I think his father was still the main ruler, but Belshazzar was in charge of Babylon, the city at the time. So whoever could interpret this is going to be next in line. And now all the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished or perplexed. So here's, you know, Belshazzar. He is the king of Babylon. And this chapter is going to tell us about the last day of Babylon. This chapter is all about the fall of Babylon, as we'll see in the next few verses. And we might think that's just of historic interest, but the fall of Babylon has got some relevance, because if seven times pass over Babylon, if we take that application, that 2,520 years pass over Babylon, and if Babylon thereafter comes back to strength in the end times, and after all, the book of Daniel was sealed until the time of the end, and this is when it's most relevant, we might find, might we not, that Babylon exists again. And if it's going to exist again, it must fall again, because God's kingdom is to be established. And do the scriptures point out that there will be a Babylon in the end time? And will it fall? And will the stories of the fall of Babylon here have some relevance to the fall of Babylon then? Well, hold your place and let's turn to Revelation chapter 17. I think we said before, and Mr. Armstrong, I'm sure, said this a number of times, that Daniel and Revelation sort of go together. You can't understand the book of Revelation unless you have a good understanding of the book of Daniel, because there's just so many echoes from one to another, so many of the symbols in the one appear in the other, and the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation, really, they assist, they help each other. So is there a Babylon in the end time? Will it exist? Will it oppose God? Will it be like Belshazzar and be blasphemous and so on? Well, we'll start in chapter 17, verse 1. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, this is to John, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Remember, you got Belshazzar there, the king, what's he doing? He's having a drunken orgy. His lords, nobles, other kings, are there drinking, engaging with him, wine, concubines, an orgy of some sort, on the last day of ancient Babylon. Verse 5, on her forehead, this great harlot, a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. So, Book of Revelation says at the end time, there will be something called Babylon the Great. Mystery, Babylon the Great. So is Babylon gone forever? Well, no, because clearly at the end time there is a Babylon the Great. Verse 6, and I saw the woman, this harlot, Babylon the Great, drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. So, you know, John's amazed when he sees this great harlot named Babylon the Great. And notice that she is responsible for the death of saints and martyrs. If we turn to chapter 18, and we'll read in verse 1 through 10, Revelation 18, 1 through 10, is there a Babylon? Will there be a Babylon in the end time? Will it fall? After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory, and he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a habitation of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. So yeah, Babylon is fallen, and of course before you can fall, you must rise. So yeah, there will be a Babylon in the end times. And it says here that Babylon has fallen. And of course, Daniel 5, when we get back to it, we'll see the initial fall of Babylon the Great in his day. But carrying on here, verse 3, for all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. So God's people, it looks like some of God's people are going to be very closely linked to this particular Babylon, because the angel says, come out of her, my people. Get out of there, come out. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Render to her just as she rendered to you, and repay her double according to her works. In the cup which she has mixed, mix for her double. In the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow. For she says in her heart, I sit as queen and am no widow, and will not see sorrow. Therefore, her plagues will come in one day. Death, mourning and famine, and she'll be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. So how quickly will the end come? It says the plagues will come in one day. Verse 9, and the kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, alas! Alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. So Babylon's end is dramatic and sudden. And notice that, you know, she has illicit relations with kings around the whole world. Okay, let's go back to Daniel chapter 5. Excuse me. What we're seeing here in Daniel 5, excuse me, is the fall, the original fall of the original Babylon, and I guess there'll be some similarities that we may see nearer the time. Anyway, the king has asked his best wise men, and they've come up with a note so far. And verse 8, that was, all the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king his interpretation. Verse 10, the queen, and this is probably the queen mother, they reckon, because all the king's wives were there earlier on in verses 2 and 3. This is another lady, probably it's thought, the queen mother. The queen, or queen mother, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. And the queen spoke, saying, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy God. And the days of your father, or grandfather, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers, inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. Clearly this is the queen mother, who was somewhat older than Belshazzar. She'd remember these events perhaps even firsthand. Then Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father or ancestor or grandfather, the king, brought from Judah? I have heard of you, because this was about 65 years earlier. Daniel's probably about 80, 85 years old now. So we're talking about the passage of a long, long time. The fall of Babylon, which is taking place in this chapter, was 539 BC. And Daniel was probably captured in sort of about 605-ish, whatever. So, you know, something like 65 years have passed since Daniel arrived as a young teenager. He's probably 82, 3, 4, 85 here. And clearly, you know, Belshazzar hadn't caught on much about him. I have heard of you that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now, the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation. But they could not give the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of you that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple, have a chain of gold around your neck, and shall be third ruler in the kingdom. Because there's my dad, there's me, and then there'll be you. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, keep your gifts. Let your gifts be for yourself, and give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king, and make known to him the interpretation. And it's, of course, bad news again. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, or grandfather, ancestor, a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. Whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men, his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men, and appoints over it whomever he chooses. But you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. And you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. And here's a specific. You have brought, or they have brought, the vessels of his house before you, and you, your lords, your wives, your concubines have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron and wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know, and the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and this writing was written, and this is the inscription that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. And that's what was there. And now Daniel says this is what it means. This is the interpretation of each word. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. You are inadequate. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. And that was the simple explanation. You're over, you're out, you're finished. You know, God's numbered your kingdom, it says, verse 26, and finished it. Yeah, to number or to count is what many means. It's been counted, it's been weighed, it's been divided. So you could, many, many is repeated, of course, many, many, tekel, uparsin, which is really number, number, weigh, and divide. And that was the message. And Belshazzar was true to his word. Verse 29, Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple, put a chain of gold around his neck, and made a proclamation concerning him, that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. But, verse 30, that very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. And Darius the Mede of Medo-Persia received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So within an hour or two or three or four of Daniel explaining what the writing the wall meant, Belshazzar was dead. And in fact, the Babylonian Empire fell on that very same night. So its conclusion was really quite dramatic. Now here's this king and his lords and nobles drinking, revelry, in a sense scoffing at the God of heaven, taking the utensils from the temple and worshipping, you know, their gods and goddesses with them, and just feeling, you know, so arrogant and filled with pride. And by morning, Babylon, the great city, which was almost impregnable, had fallen to the Medes and the Persians. The head of gold was replaced by the chest of silver. Many, many, tekel, and parson. Now we'll come back to that in a minute, but just a quick bit of history. There was a historian who lived just a few decades after these events took place, a man called Herodotus, who wrote a history about 80 years later, and he explained to the readers of that day just how strong the city of Babylon was. You know, it was potentially something like 60 miles in circumference all around. It had got a wall that was something like 300 feet high, and so broad you could race chariots. And on the top of it, it had got gates of brass. I mean, there's no way, frankly, without a huge, long siege lasting years and years and years, that you could overcome the city of Babylon. There were, you know, fields, herds of cattle inside. Euphrates went right through the city, divided it in two. It had water, food, armies inside the walls. It had two sets of walls. The inner wall was almost as strong as the outer wall. There's no way that Babylon could fall. And of course, you know, Belshazzar and his team were quite relaxed. Because I guess at the end of the day, you know, if somebody was going to try and attack Babylon, it'll be a long battle lasting potentially for years. And the Babylonians, of course, had a renowned history of being good at fighting. But there was some sneakery came in here, because Cyrus was the man in charge of the Persian Empire, and Herodotus writes as follows. Cyrus placed a portion of his army at the point where the river Euphrates enters the city, and another body of army at the back of the place where the river comes out, with orders to march into the town by the bed of the stream, as soon as the waters became shallow enough. So here's this big river, Euphrates, going into Babylon at one end and flowing all the way through it for miles and miles, coming out the far end under these huge, strong, broad, impenetrable walls. But how can you get in? How can you get armies, you know, in where the river goes? Because the river is obviously flowing quite high through the walls. But carrying on, it says that Cyrus then made for a particular place where he turned the Euphrates by a canal, into a marsh, on which the river sank to such an extent that the natural bed of the stream became fordable. So what he did was he had his guys dig a canal up the Euphrates, and it diverted all the water, or a large amount of it, into this marsh area. And as a consequence, the river Euphrates started to sink. Instead of being high through the walls of Babylon, it started to sink lower and lower as the water was diverted elsewhere, until eventually it became, you know, you could walk through it. Carrying on from Herodotus, hereupon the Persians, who had been left for the purpose at Babylon by the riverside, entered the stream, which had now sunk so as to reach about midway up a man's thigh, so maybe, what, I don't know, 2-3 feet, and thus got into the town. So night time is dark, they enter the riverbed, the water's only up to above their knees, and with all their, you know, equipment, they march through the city's walls, get inside the city from both the front and the back. It says, had the Babylonians been aware of what Cyrus was about, or had they noticed the danger, they would have made fast all the street gates which gave upon the river, because there was a defense there. But as it was, the Persians came upon them by surprise, and so took the city. It says, they knew nothing of what had chanced, but as they were engaged in a festival, continued dancing and reveling until they learnt the capture all too certainly. And that's what Herodotus wrote. So, you know, Cyrus was quite a master strategist here. He diverted the Euphrates and allowed his armies to sneak in through the much lower water supplies. And so Belshazzar, it says, was slain that night. And that was the end of the Babylonian Empire. And then Darius the Mede of the Medo-Persian Empire became the king under Cyrus. Okay, and so Daniel chapter 6. One other thing to mention there is a reference to many tekel uparsin, is that many pointed out, I first heard Mr. Hay mention this. I only heard Dr. Herman Hay once, and that was in a tape message. I've never heard him in person, but he gave a tape message, and it's the only one I've ever heard. I think it was 1981 or 1982, where he explained that many tekel uparsin has a further meaning, which is that each of those is actually a weight of money. Many is actually a mina. A tekel is a shekel, and a perez is a unit of coinage, which is worth half a mina. So the logic goes as follows. If you got a piece of paper, a mina is 50 shekels in value. Okay, so mina, many is 50 shekels and 50 shekels. A tekel is 1 shekel, and a perez is half a mina, which is 25 shekels. So 50 plus 50 plus 1 plus 25 means you've got a total of 126 shekels. Okay, a shekel is equal to 20 gerahs, G-E-R-A-H-S. And that means 126 shekels is equal to 2,520 units. And so once again, the implication here is that just as in Daniel 4 we saw that 7 times, which is 2,520 years, would pass over Babylon, so here, when you count the kingdom, that's what it says, you know, count or number, then you count the number of units in many tekel and perez, it comes to 2,520 units. Is that significant? Well, some say yes and some say no, which is standard for prophecy. Anyway, Daniel chapter 6. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps, to be over the whole kingdom, and over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them, so that the king would suffer no loss. So Darius sets up his particular government, and he decides he'll have three, you know, top dogs, which Daniel's going to be one of them, and 120 satraps who report to the top dogs, of which, you know, Daniel will have a third of that. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. Here's, you know, Daniel now 80 plus, but the guy is just, he's got it. He's just like so good, so sharp, so wise, so righteous, that he's clearly outstanding. He's the best of the best of the best. And so Darius thinks, well, I think he ought to be the top of everything, really. I can relax then and just watch, you know, some more football on the TV. And this guy can run the country, almost. Verse 4, so the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because, unfortunately for them, he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. That's trouble, isn't it? And try and get the guy into trouble so he can be, you know, railroaded out of office, and he just does things right. He's without fault. Verse 5, then these men said, we shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. And so they decided they would trap him. And they decided they would put together, you know, some sort of, they would conspire and find a way to make a righteous man guilty. And I think we should understand that at the end of this age, that the men and women of God who are living right, there will be conspiracies to make that right wrong in the eyes of the government and against the beast and so on. And just as they were trying to trap Daniel here, God's people are going to be in danger of being entrapped in the end time. But of course, you know, Daniel was faithful. And Daniel survived, and those who remain faithful to God will survive, but there'll be plenty of people in high office, plenty of government leaders in education, in science, in industry, who'll be looking for ways and means to trap the people of God. You can guarantee it. There's nothing in the book of Daniel that hasn't got relevance to our end time, and here's a great man of God whom you cannot possibly fault, and so they're going to make up charges against him. And then trap him, and that will happen, bound to happen in the end time. So these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said to him, King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom, this is a lie, by the way, because Daniel was a governor, and clearly he wasn't part of this, so this was a misrepresentation. All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators, satraps, counselors, advisors, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. We've all agreed that. And, okay. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. I guess he got his signet ring and, you know, pressed into the wax, and that was it. And this apparently was true. The law of the Medes and Persians was that once the law was in place, it was there. He couldn't change it, and the king himself was subject to it. And so all the satraps and the two governors and so on and so forth reckon they've now got Daniel because he's going to fall foul of this, isn't he? Because he's well known. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day, and prayed, and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days, and he's now probably 80 plus. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying, as of course they would, and making supplication before his God. And of course they were all watching, they got their CCTV cameras tuned in his room, and the spies were listening with their hearing devices at the wall, and yeah, he's praying to this Jehovah person again, come on, let's go and get him. And they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. King, Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, Yes, that's true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. So the answer said before the king, Well, O king, that Daniel, who is one of the captives of Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition 3 times a day. And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased. But noticed, not with Daniel, was greatly displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. The king was not pleased at all. He saw straight away, I've been set up, haven't I? These guys who are jealous about Daniel, who really is supremely outstanding in his job, they've trapped Daniel and they've trapped me. They made me sign a decree and they told me that all the governors were for it. Obviously that's not true, because Daniel obviously wasn't. And I've signed it, and you can't go back. It's the law of the Medes and the Persians. I can't retract it. So it says he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver Daniel. He tried hard. He got other counsel and said, well, is it a loophole? Is there some way around this? Is it an alternative penalty? What can we do? How can I get Daniel out of this problem, which my foolishness and those bunch of liars has trapped me into? Then these men approached the king and said to the king, No, king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. So, you know, they were thronging before the king saying, cut it out, O King Darius, sir. You can't go back. This is the law. You got to follow through with it, O king. Got that, O king? And so the king is not going to be a happy bunny at all. Verse 16, so the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. But I guess he wasn't for sure, but maybe he thought, well, you know, Daniel's so outstanding that surely his God would recognize that. Maybe, I don't know. Then a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. So there's poor old Daniel at 80-something years of age, tossed into some sort of den where there's lions. And these lions would be, I'm sure, prepared by not being fed for the previous 3 weeks. So probably anything that walked in there, whether it was a fly or a mouse, it was gone within seconds. So here's poor old Daniel in there, and then a stone laid over it and sealed, so that's it. Now the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting, meaning nothing to eat, nothing to drink, and no musicians were brought before him. So even his iPod was taken away for the night. Also, his sleep went from him, just lying there, you know, feeling guilty, feeling some, I guess, annoyance at these other guys looking at the ceiling, and just lying there. And the king arose very early in the morning, and maybe 4 o'clock in the morning or something, and went in haste to the den of lions. He hasn't slept all night, his eyes are red, he doesn't feel too good. He reckons this could be it, probably just paid to the wisest man in the kingdom after all these decades of loyal service, and oh dear. When he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel, a mournful voice. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? And he's waiting, and then a voice comes back, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, by the way, I have done no wrong before you. Then the king was exceedingly glad for him. I'm sure he was. This is all genuine. Daniel was a great guy, and the king recognized it, and he's just like, wow, he's probably doing cartwheels, and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den. I guess it's like a load him down or something, and maybe throw down a rope and And Daniel wraps around him and they pull him out. And no injury whatever was found on him because he believed in his God, a man of faith. No injury. So not even any scratches where a lineman come across and just a quick, just to try out and see what he could do. But Daniel comes out and he's perfectly fine. All accounts, he probably had a better night's sleep in there than King Darius. Because Daniel's down there and he probably recognizes within seconds that these lions are just lying there. And maybe Daniel saw the angel, maybe he just knew he was there. But either way, Daniel probably just thought, well, I'm down here and it's a bit dark. No books to read, no TV to watch. I'll get comfy in the corner over here, perhaps lie against this lion, he's quite warm and soft. And I'll just have a good night's sleep thinking about it. Nothing else to do down here. And the poor old king's tossing and turning all night. Verse 24, and the king gave the command, because kings are kings, and he brought those men who'd accused Daniel, and don't forget, that was the high and the mighty, that was the governors and the satraps and all that lot, and cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives, because these kings in those days were not the most compassionate of people. So the whole families, the whole lot, were cast in, and the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. So who knows what that signifies, but it was like a complete frenzy. I don't know how many lions were in there, whether it's 5 or 50 lions or 100 lions, but all these guys and the families get thrown in, and suddenly there's fur everywhere, fur and gnashing and blood and bones and stuff everywhere. Quite something. Then King Darius wrote, just like Nebuchadnezzar had done a bit earlier, King Darius wrote, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you, just like an epistle. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. They recognized a king who's got power. Verse 27, he delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. And so this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus of the Persian. Okay, well, that's probably as good a spot as any to finish. So we see Daniel continuing really his quite incredible period of service and prophesying, really quite an individual. And of course, one day, hopefully, you and I will get the opportunity to meet the self-same Daniel, and we can ask him a few questions about the lion's den and what was it like and so on and so forth. But okay, we'll conclude our Bible study there for today.